Okay. Okay.
Good morning. We will call the State Government Finance Committee meeting to order on Tuesday, January 18th. We do have a quorum, so would someone care to move the minutes that are before you from our last meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the minutes of January the 13th.
Representative Benson moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing or hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Well, as we announced last week, today is Pension Day, and we've got a number of presenters that are going to be appearing before us today. And we have asked them to cover some things in particular, to first of all give us an update, especially the new members of the legislature, as to the recent changes that were made in our pension system. Last session we had significant reform, and so we want members to be briefed and reminded about the changes that were made before. We've also asked everyone to give us a status update as to the current condition of the various funds and what the current issues may be facing those particular funds. And then thirdly, we've asked everyone to talk about issues that need to be addressed going forward as we work our way through the process of developing a pension bill going forward. So those and many other questions will be addressed as we go through. And so we will call forward our first presenter, Mr. Larry Martin. Welcome, Mr. Martin. If you'd please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I'm going to try and cover very quickly for you the areas that the chairman has asked me to cover. He's outlined them for you just a minute ago, and then open it up for whatever time he wants to have questions to any of the questions that you may have. Thought I would start first with the legislative process, how the legislature handles pension matters. I work for the joint entity that handles pensions currently, but that's not always the way pensions was handled. If you go back into the 50s or 60s, pensions were handled by the committee that had jurisdiction over that type of employee. Hence, judges' pensions were handled by the Judiciary Committee, teachers' pensions were handled by the Education Committee, and so on. Things were centralized more in the late 1960s and into the 70s, where there was the general jurisdiction of public employee pensions was within the governmental operations committees, and specifically within the pension subcommittees of the governmental operations commission, the governmental operations committees. The pension commission that I work for was formed as an interim entity in 1957, made a permanent entity of the state legislature in 1967, and has functioned really as the joint subcommittees on pensions of the two governmental operations committees for most of its history. The pension commission is made up of 10 members of the legislature. 5 are appointed by the House Speaker, 5 are appointed by the subcommittee on committees of the Senate Rules Committee. The commission appoints or elects its own chair and other officers, has a small staff. With me today is Ed Burek, who's the deputy director of the pension commission. We have 2 other clerical employees also. We also retain a consulting actuary from Milwaukee to review and analyze the actuarial work prepared by the various public employee pension funds. What happened in 2010 is the next topic. I've provided you a large chart, a large paper comparison This is our summary of the 2010 financial sustainability legislation. This was the first article of the 2010 omnibus pension bill. The Pension Commission typically rolls all of the pension legislation from any given session into a single or small number of omnibus pension bills. It'll be made up of a number of articles. The first article in 2010 was the sustainability legislation. And this tries to give you a graphic sense of what was passed in 2010. Minnesota is blessed or otherwise with a large number of public employee pension plans. We are the state with the second largest number of public employee pension plans. Pennsylvania has the largest with somewhere in excess of 3,000. We have in the neighborhood of 800 public employee pension plans. But most of those public employee pension plans are small volunteer fire plans that provide lump sum pensions and are cover a very modest number of public employees or quasi-public employees and have very small liabilities or assets in total. The bulk of our plans are in the statewide and major local plans, and they're contained on that chart. Running along the horizontal, along the top, are the names of the various statewide or major local public pension plans, and then the various items that changed in 2010 are run along the left-hand margin, the vertical. What happened in 2010, without going into each plan specifically and going through it in huge detail, which I can if you have questions, was a combination of benefit reductions, principally or most significantly perhaps the first set of boxes, the changes in the post-retirement adjustments for the future for retirees. Benefit changes for retirees, benefit reductions for active members, and some of the next set of boxes will be active member benefit changes, largely in the interest paid to refunds or the augmentation provided for deferred annuities, and I can get into that if you're interested. There also were changes that will involve new employees, so typically longer vesting for some new employees, some other changes for new employees. There also were contribution increases, both by members or employers, and then there was also some changes in actuarial assumptions, which are not on that page, and in the case of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, an increase in state aid. So those are the general sense of what occurred in 2010. The most significant matters are probably the changes in post-retirement adjustments. I should note that a class action suit has been started in Ramsey County District Court by members of the Minnesota State retirees of the Minnesota State Retirement System, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and the Teachers Retirement Association. Those are typically known as the Big Three: MSRS General Plan, PERA General, and TRA. That suit was filed mid-summer, was heard initially in September, postponed, further deliberations postponed for purposes of gaining more discovery during the course of the fall and early winter, and is scheduled to be argued again the middle of March in Judge Greg Johnson's courtroom. That change or that contest specifically is focused on the reduction in post-retirement adjustments that was provided for in 2010.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question to a point he just made?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, you mentioned Minneapolis Retirement Fund. For the sake of the new members coming in, could you just point out which of these they have some acronyms at the top of these list here that probably don't speak the new people's language yet.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, during the course of 2010, as part of the omnibus pension legislation, There also was a consolidation of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, an administrative consolidation into the Public Employees Retirement Association General Plan. So MRF is not, MRF is the way that the Minneapolis plan is usually referred to. It's now known as the MRF division of PERA. It's not on this set of, it's not on this chart. There was a change in, with respect to the post-retirement adjustments in MRF. They are now receiving the same post-retirement increase as PERA General. And so for purposes of this comparison, they weren't contained in the first article of the omnibus pension bill. It was in a later article. So the principal change there was the post-retirement adjustment rate, where their post-retirement adjustment rate was also reduced.
Proceed.
Members, if you're interested in getting a sense of the current condition or current shape of the Minnesota public pension plans, you turn to the larger packet that I handed out. And if you look in the right-hand corner, it's paginated on the right-hand corner, flip to page 31. I have there a brief comparison of the three largest of our Minnesota public pension plans, MSRS General, PERA General, and TRA. And if you run down to items C and D, this compares the current liabilities of these plans and the current assets of these plans. Minnesota tracks the funded status of our pension plans, both using something called the actuarial value of assets, and that's item C, and also the market value of assets, which is the fair market value of assets under general accounting standards, and that's item D. And you can get a sense of where these plans sit currently. All three of the major plans have unfunded pension liabilities. They are larger under the market value of assets measure than they are under the actuarial value assets measure. The actuarial value of assets is a device that was proposed or recommended to the Pension Commission by its consulting actuary about a decade ago. It's common in public employee pension plans. The idea is to use some sort of a multi-year smoothing device that will take out some of the what is presumed to be temporary volatility in the investment markets. And so what it tends to do is to delay the recognition of losses when large losses occur, and it also delays the recognition of gains in the market when there's an up market. The idea being that over time this will give you a smoother, a less choppy, if you were to chart the funding condition of the various pension plan assets, it will give you a smoother look over time. But this gives you a general sense of the major three pension plans. If you take a look at page 32 in the next several pages in my handout, I provide for you the market value of assets comparison of our various pension plans broken out by broad type. So page 32 is the statewide general employee plans, the big three. Our statewide public safety plans would be on page 33. This is MSRS Correctional, State Patrol, PERA Police and Fire, and PERA Correctional. What we call the statewide specialty plans would appear on page 34. This is the elective state officers, the old constitutional officers plan, which has been phased out and has no active members. The judges retirement plan, which is an ongoing open plan to active members. The legislators plan, which was closed in 1997 to new members, and that's on page 34. The first-class city retirement plans appear on page 35. This is the Duluth Teachers, St. Paul Teachers, and MRF. This is MRF prior to the administrative consolidation into PPERA. So this will give you a sense of what the various plans look like currently. We've touched base briefly on the asset valuation methods that are used. This is the difference between the actuarial value of assets and the market value of assets.
Excuse me, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, you're saying currently, and at the top of page 31, you're talking about 2010. Is that the beginning of 2010, January 2010, or is that June 2010, or is it December 2010?
Mr. Chairman, our representative, this is as of the valuation date, which is asset values as of June 30th and liabilities as of July 1, 2010.
Thank you.
So it's middle of the year. It's the state fiscal year.
Representative Downey?
I think that's my question.
Same question. Okay. Proceed, Mr. Martin.
The chair also asked for some sense of what pending problem areas, issue areas that I can identify for you. And I provided you a separate handout which has 10 items on it with a brief discussion of each. I'll just quickly run through them, and then we can take them up.
Excuse me, Mr. Martin. Representative Kahn, did you have a prior question?
I noticed looking at this chart that the Duluth deficiency went down dramatically from 09 to Duluth teachers dramatically from 09 to 10. Was that because of taking off the health benefits? Was that the or was that done?
Could be just
Mr. Chairman, our representative, the Duluth health benefits are not part of the actuarial valuation. It's not a benefit that's provided by the Duluth pension fund. It is something that's provided by the Duluth school district. So no, the any change in the Duluth health coverage is not reflected here. It's simply a change in the market value of assets 2009 to 2010. And the reduction in liabilities that accompanied the downsizing in post retirement adjustments that occurred in the 2010 omnibus pension bill.
Well, I mean,
so it's a reduction in liabilities and an increase in assets provide
okay,
you a better
compared to all the others. That's a big jump that went down by two. And if there's any analysis of why that happened, I'd be interested in knowing that.
Members, then on the other short paper handout that I have for you, I've identified some issues that are fairly that have been around for long standing, or I can flag as potential future issues. What's labeled there is item A, the appropriate approach to providing public sector pension benefits. This is the question of defined contribution or defined benefit plans. The 2010 legislation mandated the three major plans to study the issue of alternative approaches to providing pension benefits. That report is due in June of 2011. So this is the question of defined contribution versus defined benefit. Most of our public employee pension plans in the state of Minnesota are defined benefit plans. B is the question of contribution rates, the sufficiency of the current funding provided to our public employee pension plans, and that's some of the financial numbers you just looked at. C is a question of odd disparities between plans. Among teacher plans, TRA provides a larger benefit formula than do the first class city teacher plans. We also have a disparity with respect to normal our retirement ages. Employees after 1989 in our general employee plans are not covered by the rule of 90. Individuals before July 1, 1989 are covered by the rule of 90. That is a sore point among pension plan members and sometimes finds voice in the legislature. The item D is the question of local retirement plans. There's been a general trend in Minnesota pensions to either fully consolidate or at least consolidate on an administrative basis local retirement plans. We have the Duluth and St. Paul teachers plans. We also have four remaining local police or paid fire plans that have not previously consolidated, two in Minneapolis, a police plan in Fairmont, and a fire plan in Virginia. You may well see a bill to administratively consolidate the Virginia fire during the course of this session. We've discussed the question of actuarial value of assets versus market value of assets and the logic of valuing things on two bases rather than one. F has to do with how we amortize public employee pensions in Minnesota. For some period of time now, we've been amortizing our plans, paying off the unfunded as a level percentage of an increasing pay basis rather than a level dollar. Most individuals who have mortgages, you're paying a level dollar payment to your mortgage holder. We fund things on a level percentage of covered pay. This tends to work out to be a balloon towards the end of the amortization period and not even the payment of full interest on the unfunded during the early years of the amortization period. And the viability of that is the item here. Actual assumptions, especially economic assumptions. This is the question of primarily what is the appropriate interest rate to be using in valuing our public employee pension plans. Currently, an 8.5% interest rate assumption is what's used for most of our public employee pension plans. Some commentators have suggested that it ought to be a lower interest rate and a much lower interest rate. The corresponding change here is the lower the interest rate that's used to discount future liabilities, the larger the contribution has to be to the public employee pension plan. H has to do with investment strategy.
Excuse me, Representative Downey, you had a question.
Yeah, to that point, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If you could, Mr. Martin. I remember this very question in my mind when we were looking at the pension bill last year. The actuarial assumptions that are written into statute, and I don't know, it's like Section 353, so you're probably pretty familiar. It lays out those 8.5% pre-retirement interest assumptions and 6% post-retirement interest assumptions, and then it goes on, and there's a really large table showing estimated future salary increases, and that table ranges anywhere from 3.5% up to 11% salary assumptions. I don't need like a detailed actuarial definition here, but can you explain to me and the committee where those values come from? Are they reset periodically? Are they why aren't they indexed to some kind of market values as compared to actually writing them into statute? And how big an impact do some of these assumptions have on that very question of unfunded liabilities?
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes. 356.215 subdivision 8 is the interest rate and the salary rate assumptions used in Minnesota pensions. There are other demographic actuarial assumptions that are not set forth. There are set recommended by the pension plan actuary and either approved or not approved by the pension commission. Historically, we've set interest and salary rate assumptions in statute because we wanted the entire legislature to be involved in the setting of those rates. They're the most critical two rates. How fast salaries grow sets for you the estimate of how large a future pension someone will receive. The discount rate that you use to back that liability into a present value is the interest rate assumption, and that's key to valuing the plan, and probably the two largest influencers on liabilities. They're set periodically and reset periodically. Statute provides for a quadrennial experience study to be done by the major pension plans, where actual experience is compared to what was predicted, and when the deviations get large, then based on the actual experience, recent experience, and other factors, they're reset. So, for instance, this year, PERA's salary rate assumptions were reset in statute. Likely, there will be some resetting of the MSRS and TRA salary assumptions also. That was recommended in the most recent experience study, and is remaining something that the pension commission needs to take a look at. So they are reset periodically. They are reset based on actual experience. There also will be a question of resetting mortality assumption, other assumptions that came out of the most recent experience study.
Mr. Martin, it is correct, is it not, that assumptions on growth in recent years, as well as assumptions about compensation increases, have proven to be inaccurate, and that has in fact compounded the problem in terms of unfunded liability?
Mr. Chair, actuarial assumptions by their nature are probably always inaccurate in any given year. There will be gains and there will be losses. The idea is to predict these things over the long term and to get them correct over the long term. In your packet, if you look on page 37 of the larger packet, what I've provided for you is an assessment of the gains and losses between 2009 and 2010. It would be the middle of this chart where it lays out actuarial assumption gain or loss. Anything that's in parentheses is a gain. Anything that's not in parentheses is a loss. State law requires the actuary to track annually the specific gain or loss related to three major items, salary increase, investment return, and mortality. And then if the other category gets too large to break that out, what the specific cause was. But you can get some flavor here that there are on this page both numbers in parentheses and numbers not in parentheses. You can get a sense of the fact that every year the actual experience of the pension plan is a mixture of gains and losses. Great Recession of 2007 through 2009, or whatever its ending point is clearly an impact on the current unfunded pension liabilities. And the actuarial assumptions when salaries are not going up for lots of reasons, when investment return is not very great, would produce significant disparities. The depression on salaries actually works to the positive of the pension fund. It is a gain when salaries don't go up. It's a problem for the public pension plan when investment return does not match it, the actuarial assumption. In the case for most of our plans, 8.5%.
Representative Downey, to this point?
Just to answer my question. Thank
okay.
You.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, I'm new to pensions, so I'm probably sort of naive and don't know that much about it. But it is the only process, so what you just said, sometimes it doesn't match. If a legislator introduced a bill to get those to match closer, there's rumors of such a bill coming forward, it can just go through the regular process, right? It can subvert, it can go around the process laid out about doing the study and laying every, you know, going through a more thoughtful process.
Representative Mr. Martin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. yes, the legislature sets the interest and salary rate assumptions in statute. The Pension Commission is advisory to the two governmental operations committees and to this committee, to the extent that a bill would impact general fund funding of pension plans. The committee structure in the Minnesota legislature is advisory to the entire body, so clearly the entire body can do what it will. The debate, if there would be a debate, would be presumably on the factual accuracy of a new interest rate assumption or a new salary rate assumption, and whether you looked at only very, very short-term data, one or two or a small number of years, versus a longer-term data set, and how viable that as a long-term assumption for the future might be.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Martin, page 37 is just the one-year change?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes.
And so if
changes like this, charts like this, can be produced for whatever period of time one would want to look.
Would you be able to do a similar chart with the gain or loss on the assumptions over the 10-year period, the last 10 years?
Certainly. I'd be happy to do that for you if you'd like that.
I think a longer period would be helpful to... okay. As far as I'm concerned, this is one of the key issues we need to face as a legislature, mm-hmm. how we approach this whole issue of assumptions.
Yeah. Okay, I will forward that to you before the end of the week.
Thank you. Proceed.
The last two items I had on my list of 10 problem areas, issue areas that you might want to be looking at, our state aid programs and the appropriate manner for the state to obtain actuarial information. The state aid programs is probably of particular concern to this particular committee. In this case, I'll have you take a look, if you would, at page 8 of this handout. This is where I try to give you a sense of the state aid programs, 8 and 9. Some but not all of the state aid programs that relate to public employee pensions are in the jurisdiction of this particular committee. Exactly how it all happened is not clear to me, but about a decade or so ago, the where the various pension aids fall in the various targets was modified, and about 80% of the non teacher funding, the non-education aids, pension-related credits or aids, landed in the tax committee's targets, and only about 20% of that money landed in your targets. But there are a large number of state aid programs for pension plans. Some are more recent vintages. Some of them are very, very old, like the Fire State Aid Program, which dates back to the 1870s. These benefit or reduce the funding obligations that employing units would otherwise have to bear. The Fire State Aid, for instance, is the primary funder, probably 60 or 70% of the funding of all of our volunteer fire pension programs. In many jurisdictions, the employing unit, the governmental unit, makes no contribution or a very nominal contribution to its volunteer fire pension program. The bulk of the funding is fire state aid. So some of these programs are very, very important in particular localities. They are somewhat intertwined over recent years, and they are somewhat confusing. To try and do a flow chart of these becomes a bit of a Fibber-McGee's closet exercise. To give you some sense of dollars, the most recent numbers I had readily available are laid out on page 9 of the what the number of dollars in thousands are for the various programs. The only inaccuracy by picking up an old chart is the MRF number here is listed at 9 million, and it was increased by the 2010 legislature. So for the future, it would be larger. I believe it was an extra $13 or $15 million that was added to MRF funding. But this will give you some sense of the aid programs, which are greatly intertwined, some of which are in the jurisdiction of your committee. Others are in the jurisdiction of the tax committee because they're considered local property tax aid or credit programs. The last item is just actuarial information. The once upon a time, the pension funds had their own actuaries and provided data to the pension commission. In 1984, the legislature was dissatisfied with that and centralized the provision of actuarial information to an actuary retained by the pension commission. We have now gone back in recent years to the prior system of having each pension fund have its own actuary. And the question of who provides the information and as a consequence how reliable or accurate it is always a question for the pension commission.
Mr. Martin, you give us a list of which of those local aids come under the jurisdiction of this committee as far as you're concerned, or the tax committee, and maybe Mr. Shepherd could also.
Can also probably tell you, but I'd be happy to send you up a list, sure.
Thank you. Representative Leidiger, you had a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm brand new at this. I've been trying to study this in the last couple of days. In this handout, I'd like to go back to this one on page 32. And I'm trying to understand the scope of this. Am I correct in saying that the total membership, right up on the top, you know, you go all the way across, it says general employees plans, there's 644,531 people that are going to or are in the retirement plans, these three major plans, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And there's 5,300,000 people in Minnesota, so we're saying 1 in 8 people in the state are receiving a pension or going to receive a pension?
Mr. Martin. Chair, Representative, either are receiving a pension, are currently covered by a public employee pension plan, or at one time were covered. The non-vested former members, especially with when you look at PERA, they're the largest generator of that number. These are folks who have spent some time in the public sector, have left their member contributions in the PERA plan, are not yet, they don't have 3 or more years of service credit, and their status is unclear. They could be somewhere else in the public sector. They could have gone from local government employment covered by PERA to state government employment. They could have become teachers. They may eventually draw a pension, so they may be in effect double counted because they may be mobile employees. They may have shifted employment. But from PERA's standpoint, for instance, they're on the books. They have to keep track of these folks to some extent because they're either going to come back to get a refund in the future, or they're going to come back at some future date to get a pension benefit.
So there might be some double counting, but these are the three major ones, and then there's a bunch more that aren't counted. So I come from the private sector. That means seven people of the eight are supporting these pension plans. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around the size of government. This is huge. Is this, are all states like this?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, a representative, I'm probably not the best one to ask. The state demographer or someone who actually keeps track of it would be better to ask. It's my understanding that Minnesota is on the low end of the number of public employees versus population, and other states are higher, but I can't tell you where exactly we rank.
Representative Leidiger, we can probably find someone who can get an answer to that question for you.
Thanks, sir.
The further question that might come from this exchange is, of that $644,000. Could you estimate, or do you have the numbers as to what percentage of that number are on defined contribution versus defined benefit?
Mr. Chair, these are all defined benefit plan. The $644,000 that you're looking on page 32 are members of one of the three major pension plans, and they're defined benefit plans.
So that defined contributions would be over and above the $644,000 then. And do you have that number as to how many?
Mr. Chair, I do not have a total membership number for defined contribution plans. I can give you some information as to our the comparison between defined benefit and defined contributions currently. You turn on page 9 of the larger of the two handouts. I've laid out the defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans. I do have head counts. I do have membership counts for all the defined benefit plans. For the defined contribution plans, I do not have good counts. They're run by the respective employers, administered out by third party, and don't regularly report to the pension commission. But this gives you a sense. The top two thirds of the page are defined benefit plans. The bottom third of the page are the defined contribution plans. But unfortunately, I cannot tell you what the counts are. Can very accurately do it for the defined benefit, but not for the defined contribution plans.
Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin. I just wanted to go back to your big chart, and just to clarify, one of the line items is the post-retirement adjustments. I was wondering what the process is for setting these those increases, and who is responsible for that, and is that set in statute, or is that decided with the committees, or what?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Martin?
Yes. Representative Beep, post-retirement adjustments, like all of our defined benefit plans, are set forth in statute. So the figures that you see here are set forth in statute. Chapter 356 has a provision that governs the post-retirement increases for all of the statewide pension plans, the two major locals, the Duluth Teachers and St. Paul Teachers, would be found in 354A. So it's set through the committee process by the legislature. The 2.5% regular post-retirement increase formula was set forth in 2009. In a piece of legislation, and it was adapted, was downsized, at least while there are funding problems for all of the major pension plans. Item B here on your chart.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. And this is in effect through what date? Or is this just it's been off forever?
Mr. Chairman, the way the reductions that are in force are there until the retirement plan achieves 90% full funding on a market value of assets basis. So it's a variable proposition depending upon how well funded the plan is currently and how the investment markets do in the near term.
Thank you.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, I want to make sure, first of all, to Representative Leidiger's question, see if I got this understood as well. I'm a Minsky employee, been there since 1984. For my first 5 years, I was covered by TRA. My money still remains there, so I would be in that number, although I'm now in a defined contribution plan, have been so since 89.
Yes.
So I do have that right. So you do get double counting, not just in terms of people who were in different plans that are defined benefit, but some folks were in defined benefit and now in defined contribution plans. Make sure I have that right. Thank you. I want to go back to your page 37, Mr. Martin, please, if I could. Just to make sure I've understood this correctly. If I and I'll just work the 30,000-foot view and just look at the grand total numbers. And as I understand it, the plan year beginning that unfunded actuarially accrued liability as of is Mr. Martin, is that of January 1st? Is that Mr. Martin? Mr. Chair, or is the plan year
different? State fiscal year, so this would be July 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin. If I now read across that table, anything that's a positive number would represent an increase in the unfunded accrued liability. Anything that's negative is a decrease. So as I understand it, the number that I think might interest some people is at that bottom, the investment return being a positive $3 billion plus represents that if nothing else had changed, we would have had an increase in the size of our unfunded liability. And we then made a decrease, if I understand correctly, through the changes we made in the law last year that reduced it by almost $6 billion. So I have that correct, Mr. Martin?
Yes.
Okay, so we're now left with...
You're looking at the grand total numbers.
Correct.
On the bottom of the page. And that's principally why I was putting together this chart, was to try and provide some sense or answer for myself what the impact of the 2010 piece of legislation was. And that column that says benefit plan amendments is what you're focusing on.
That is.
The reflection of the 2010 changes.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure I understood you correctly, sir, that that we are going to ask for this going back to prior years.
Yes.
Okay. Good. And just one last follow up. This is all on an actuarial basis. This is not marked at market value.
Mr. Martin,
or no? Is that right? Do I have that right?
This is liability. Yes, Mr. Chair. These are liability numbers. So this it's not affected by whether you value the assets on an actuarial basis or a market value. The starting number and the ending number is derived from the actual liabilities reduced by the actuarial value of assets. But the middle change doesn't matter with respect to the value of the assets.
Understood. And thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Martin, one of the things you skipped over was item H, the extent of active versus passive investment strategies. And that's so I have two questions about investment strat. One, have we done a comparison of the different managers and how their what their returns are, specifically the ones who are more specifically the funds that are more dependent on passive investment, or indexed investment, and is there any difference between the different funds in terms of their investment strategies?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to give you the quick answer. Yes, those numbers are kept, and there is a difference. Mr. Bicker is later on the morning agenda and can give you the actual numbers, which I don't have.
And maybe this is, Mr. Chairman, maybe this is more appropriate for Mr. Bicker and so forth, but some other pension funds, there have been some articles in the New York Times recently about other pension funds suing the investors or questioning the investors who did heavy investments into banks in the last few years. Is there any follow-up here about do we know if any of these managers have done heavy investments into banks, particularly, you know, prior to the revelation of the mortgage crisis?
Mr. Yes. Martin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't have any specific information. Mr. Bicker would be the best source for that information.
Okay. Have Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, have you had any conversation with your counterparts in those states where they are suing? That is that something that you do or don't do or think there's any value in or whatever.
About 22 states have something comparable to the Legislative Commission on Pensions, but there is no nationwide clearinghouse, and states are unique enough to themselves that there really isn't much interplay. I don't regularly, aside from the National Conference of State Legislatures keeping tabs and contacting us regularly, we're in contact with them, keeping up to date as to what changes have occurred in other states. There isn't much interplay with other pension commissions, so I don't really know.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Cohen,
is there a specific person at either NCSL or CSG that tracks pensions, that
yes.
that works on pension issues?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Ron Snell at NCSL is their pension person.
Okay, thank you.
The final item, Mr. Chair, that you asked me to talk about briefly is the composition of the Pension Commission, specifically changes in the composition. Representative Kahn is a proponent of increasing the size of the Pension Commission. The Senate historically has been less interested in changing the size of the Pension Commission. My observation would be... since the legislature no longer has pension subcommittees of the governmental operations committees, and since the pension commission is no longer made up of purely only members of the two pension subcommittees, there is a tension between the number of people on the pension commission and the availability of people's schedules to actually have pension commission meetings. When pension commission members are drawn from the legislature at large and have very varying schedules, it's very difficult, and has been for more than a decade now, to have any time during the day virtually when pension commission meetings can be held, and that is a tension that, as you increase the number of members on the pension commission, you increasingly increase that tension. And I'm sure Representative Kahn will have
Representative Kahn.
Actually, there are currently five from each body on the Pension Commission, and I think that's far too few people to have knowledge of this very complex issue. Just to prove that compromise doesn't always work, the closest I came once, my proposal has always been to increase it to seven, which isn't really dramatic, and the bill I think is introduced today with bipartisan authorship, and the proof that compromise, the closest I ever got was 1 year when we increased it to six for a year. Now, just to show the innumeracy of most members of the legislature, when you increase the number to six as opposed to seven, it makes it harder to get a quorum. Whereas if you increase the number to seven with the specific requirement of an additional minority member, and I feel comfortable with saying this because I've pushed this all the time I was in the majority, so I'm comfortable with saying that I can do it when I'm in the minority, it actually is seven makes it easier to get a quorum than five, whereas six makes it harder to get a quorum than five. So the inability of people to understand that use of numbers was the reason that we ended up at six. So we went back to five because of the problems of getting a quorum with six. So,
thank you, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could, and Mr. Martin, first, thank you. This is really helpful information in the presentation. I think helps a lot for our own understanding. But one question back to follow up Representative Banyan's questions on the table on page 37. So just to be clear, this is using the actuarial valuations as compared to the market. And so if you have a number off the top of your head or could direct me how to kind of go back through some of the other charts to understand what the actual market value unfunded liability is. And I'm thinking just very simplistically, the first column bottom number grand total is 14 $0.4 billion, and then the after the actions of the last legislature, it's now down to $11.9 billion. What would those two numbers be if we were using market value as compared to actuarial value, given that there's some questions about the actuarial tables and the way we're arriving at those numbers?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, if you turn to page 31, our representative, I can show you a bit of what's going on here. The actuarial value of assets versus the market value of assets is only driving the planned start year number and the end year number. It doesn't have anything to do with the change items. It's strictly liability issues. If on page 31, I've given you the information for the three major pension plans, which squares up with the first block of numbers that you have on page 37, the MSRS, PERA, and TRA numbers that you have. If you look at the page 31, the total statewide general employee column, and you look at the actuarial value of assets, the unfunded is $10.116 billion, and that squares up with the number that you have at the end of the year on page 37 in the first block of numbers. Market value of assets is down in the bottom, item D on page 31, and that's 14.2 to round it billion rather than 10.1 billion. So it's about a $3 billion difference for the big three plans, and they're the, because they're the largest liabilities and the largest asset base, that's the bulk of your numbers for if you got all the way back down to the grand total.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Downey.
Some sense, we can generate the same sort of table that you have on page 31 for all the plans. I didn't include it here, simply space and just clerical time in putting this out together, but to give you some sense of this, it's the two numbers do tie together, and that's roughly the difference, about a $3 billion difference.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. That was helpful. And if you wouldn't mind drawing this, I've heard various numbers in terms of our unfunded liability, all the way from $15 billion to 20-some billion. And so just understanding the difference between the actuarial and the market base would be helpful. It sounds like that final number in the lower right, the grand total of the far right column would be somewhere in the order of maybe $16-17 billion if we did all the funding, but it'd be nice to have an actual number. If you could do the table, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler. We're going to need to move on to, we have five more folks that are going to appear before us today.
Mr. Burt will not have anything particularly extra to say, so you have four of them.
Mr. Martin, you have provided us very good information, and I appreciate that. And I think you can tell that this committee has a keen interest in this subject, and we are going to want to
prior to the omnibus pension bill for 2011. Yes.
We're going to want to be focused on this more now as this session goes through the process. Perhaps you could, to kind of wrap this up, could you talk a little bit about the Pension Commission and the development of the bill itself, the pension bill going forward? What goes into that? How is it put together? And the points at which maybe this committee might be able to offer some advice and direction with regard to that legislation.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Pension Commission works under essentially conference committee rules, so that it takes at least three members of the House and three members of the Senate to approve anything that the Pension Commission recommends. The Pension Commission hears bills in the same fashion, although we're not technically, we do not have jurisdiction of the bills. We hear bills as if we had jurisdiction over them, have a regular hearing for the bills. The bill is amended or modified by the Pension Commission, It's then a motion will be made to include it in the omnibus pension bill or not include it in the omnibus pension bill, or in some instances to send bills freestanding on their own to the standing committees. It would first go to the Governmental Operations Committee, and then however the process works, I believe the chair has the power to then have those bills re-referred to this committee. But however the process works, the omnibus pension bill or any other pension bill as recommended by the pension commission would then come to this committee. The pension commission holds hearings when we can get time and can get a quorum. So sometimes it's evening, sometimes it's been on weekends. On occasion, it varies. We only require one of the two authors. We frequently have a bill that's been introduced in both the House and the Senate. We only require one of the two authors to actually appear, although sometimes both do. Input by this committee would be presumably through having one or more members of the Pension Commission also sit on this committee. Would be probably the most effective way to have input. From a scheduling standpoint, there are a fair number of individual or special case bills that the Pension Commission needs to deal with. As a practical matter, they take as much time as a major pension bill frequently to go through the circumstance of a particular person frequently. The Pension Commission over the years has something of a claims commission aspect to it in trying to handle a situation of an individual that didn't get service credit from some prior year for some reason and now is coming close to retirement and discovered the error and wants the service credit. So the Pension Commission sometimes is bogged down in not terribly weighty matters from a broad 30,000-foot view, but very pertinent to a particular constituent. When the Pension Commission is appointed late, as it has in some odd-numbered years, they don't get going very early, and hence there's quite a pileup of legislation here that needs to be dealt with, which also affects just how much of huge substance legislation can be taken up while we're trying to accommodate members getting their special case bills heard.
Thank you for that explanation. Representative Kahn.
It really helps to have very nasty people on the Pension Commission. There was one item, because there are such sad stories with widows and orphans and, you know, young brides and things like that. There was one bill that was brought in by a unnamed Democratic DFL House member, and I think the only two DFL caucus members who voted against it were me and Representative Murphy. So just don't be careful what you ask for if you ask to be on the Pension Commission.
rebuttal, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, in the past legislative sessions, or interims, we updated the principles, and so they're fairly recent. And we also used the first interim to do the major foundation of bills. And that was something that Senator Betzel, when he was chair, wanted to do so we wouldn't have quite as much load during the session. And we met at least once a month during the interims. And so I thought that went quite well.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if Representative Kahn was suggesting that the ratio should be changed so there are more Republicans on the Pension Commission.
Well, I think there will be.
Representative Kahn. Mr. Martin, anything else that you would like to cover before we pass the torch to the next presenter? Again, I thank you for the good information you have provided us, and I think you can rest assured this committee will be in touch some more as we go through the session. Our next presenter is Mr. Ed Burick, Deputy Director of the Commission.
He's not.
Oh, he's not? Okay. Mr. Bicker, welcome.
Good.
We're changing the order. We were requested to change the order of the remaining presenters here.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I have been the director of the system.
So we changed it again. Okay.
No, I'm just going to introduce myself.
All right. So, and, go ahead.
I've been the director since 1990. Thank you for having us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the State Investment Board. I'd like to just do a brief overview of the State Investment Board and some of the returns and answer any questions if you have them. The State Board of Investment is responsible for the investment of all the state pension assets, and we also invest a number of other assets for the state. The board is comprised of the governor, the attorney general, the secretary of state, and the state auditor, and that's defined by constitution. The board has an investment advisory council made up of 17 people, 10 of which are from the local investment community, that review the various investment policies and suggestions prior to bringing them to the board.
I got you.
The retirement assets are invested in the following matter. We have a relatively aggressive equity exposure. We have 45% in domestic equities, 15% in international equities. 18% in bonds, 20% in what we call alternative investments, and 2% in cash. The returns, which are on the next page, as you can see, have been volatile. The 2000s have not been kind to the financial markets. But I think what's important is two things. One, you can see that last fiscal year, which ended on June 30th of 2010, we were up 15.2. which has helped in some of the recovery of the plans. And I think most importantly, we're talking about retirement-related assets with very long-term time horizons. You can see over the last 25 years and since 1-1 of 1980, which is over 31 years, we've compounded at over 9%. Our assumed rate of return is 8 or 8.5, depending on the time period. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I think it's important to see that over long periods of time, the pension assets have returned over the actuarial assumed rate of return. So it's very time sensitive as to how you want to lay out your returns, but we want to lay out our returns over very, very long periods of time. Also, just as a point of information for the committee, you can see at the bottom of that chart, so far in this fiscal year, and I always reluctant to talk about partial years because things can change, but so far this fiscal year we're up over 16%. Mr. Chairman and members, you can see on the next page is the returns. Investment returns are obviously very important when it comes to the funding of pension plans. The employee and employer contribute slightly over 30%. And investment returns are responsible for over two-thirds of the assets of the plan. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's a very quick review of the State Investment Board. I know we have limited time, but we respond to any questions if you have it.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bicker, one of the things that we've had some discussion about is local plans using the State Board of Investment for their retirement plans. And as you know, I've been particularly concerned about the plans that are not likely to have a lot of expertise, like ends up being mainly the volunteer firefighter plans that often just put their money in the local bank for as cash. Now, of course, at the worst period, they look like geniuses. But the question is, I think there's been a trend of more people going on, and I've always been interested in, you know, in pushing that a little further to be sure that there's some expert advice given to the, particularly the very small plants. But what's been the trend on people asking to have the State Board of Investment manage their investment plans?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, there's two answers to that. One, all volunteer relief associations can use the supplemental investment funds, which is, for lack of a better word, a bunch of mutual funds that we run that they can all participate in. We have approximately 200 of the 750 or so that utilize some of that service. The legislature also a couple years ago passed a volunteer pension plan, for lack of a better word. And if you are a volunteer plan, you can choose to go in, and once you go in, you're in. You can't get back out, and then the administration goes to PERA, the investment goes to us, and for lack of better words, you're out of the pension business, so to speak. That was passed 2 years ago, the first, and they can only come in on January 1. So we had like four or five the first year because nobody really knew what was going on. We had a dozen approximately this year. So the word is spreading. People are becoming more familiar with it, so there are more plans participating.
I guess.
Representative Kahn?
You know, and I know it varies, of course, from plan to plan, but I'd be interested in something that comes out looking at the performance of the plans that are in that plan and the plans that have remained out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if we see that, and I'd like to see it in, depending on, independent of what direction it goes in, I'd like to see it in something more understandable than the auditor's report or whatever we're going to see on this.
Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, obviously those data will be available, but it's still very early on. I mean, they're just, it's just second year.
Mr. Becker, I have very high regard for the work that you've done for us as a state in terms of our investments. I guess what is your perspective on this 8.5% assumption? Obviously, the chart that you provided us here, if you look back 30 years, 8.5% seems reasonable, but what is your perspective on the 8.5% assumption?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the only thing I can guarantee you is whether you use 8.5 or 8 or 7.5, they're wrong. You know, and it's going to be very volatile, and so on and so forth. If we were sitting here in 1999. You know, and we were asking this question, they'd say 10 is easy. We sat here in 2002, and, you know, we should be at 2. 2005, we're back to 10's no problem. And, you know, if we'd have done this 6 months ago or today, it's 4. You know, it's very, you know, it's just human nature. We're all dependent upon what just hit us most recently, and what hit us recently was a really bad economy and a lot of issues in Wall Street and the world. I happen to believe that if we have a long-term policy, both from an investment standpoint and from a pension standpoint, 8 or 8.5 are very doable. But it's got to have to be very, very long-term. You know, we lost 18.8 2 years ago. We made 15.2 last year, and assuming the markets hold, we'll be up, you know, in the teens or whatever again this year. That's very volatile, and if you're going to have a pension system and you're going to have an assumed rate of return of whatever it is, 7.5, 8, 8.5, whatever the number is, you have to have an aggressively invested portfolio. If you're going to have an aggressively invested portfolio, by definition, you're going to have volatility. So if you want to keep the cost of these systems as reasonable as possible, both from an employee and an employer standpoint, you have to have an aggressively managed portfolio. And you also have to have consistent pension policies. You know, if you have a good year, you can't spend it. You know, and if you got a bad year, everybody can't be making a whole bunch of changes. It only works if everybody's willing to work towards the same goal and for a long period of time. So, you know, the reality is if you go from 8 to 8.5 to 8, you know, that might be a goal to do once we get better funded, if we have a couple of good years, you know, and just kind of work your way towards a goal. But to do it carte blanche now and basically add costs from a, an employer standpoint and an employee standpoint, I don't think it's necessary at this stage. I think the markets will recover. I think they have done a very nice job of recovering. And hopefully going forward, we'll be able to make 8.5.
Well, Mr. Bicker, I appreciate your optimism, and I hope you're right. But I'm not nearly as optimistic as you are. And what really concerns me is the impact of the massive federal deficit and what that's going to do to the economic vitality of this country over the long haul. That's something new. I mean, the level of federal debt is something that's new to us, and I don't know if we really know what the full impact of that is going to be. I have a defined contribution pension, TIA CREF. The conventional wisdom was 4 to 5% is the most that you ought to take of that in any given year. I took that, and the bottom fell out. And I've gone down now below 1%, and I'm still way below where I was at the peak value of my fund. And that kind of experience suggests to me that you have to be pretty cautious about these things going forward. And so I thank you for your optimism, but I don't share it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I no offense, but I hope I'm right.
Well, I hope you are, too. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative Downey was first. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, maybe very briefly. The alternatives section of your investment portfolio, how alternative are those things? Are you hedging or doing private equity, or what's in that component, and how has it done from a return standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, our alternative investment program is private equity, some venture capital, some real estate, some resource funds. We do not do hedge funds.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Bicker. So I think I get your perspective on being patient and having a long-term strategy. I'm in a position in life where that makes sense. A lot of folks aren't. But maybe a broader question. So if we're assuming 8.5% and we think that's a reasonable kind of long-term sustainable return, it seems to me that at that level, maybe the best our funds have ever been funded, even after a good year, and you could correct me here, as we're somewhere up in the upper 90s, maybe 102%, I think I've seen a number. Have we ever had a circumstance where we've been way up in the 110% funding, 115% funding, and overreacted the other way that has now gotten us to the point where best case scenario, 8.5%, we're maybe going to be back up in the 90%. So anyway, it just seems to me maybe our baseline assumption of 8.5%, which seems awfully optimistic to a lot of us, gets us in that 90% rate. Every time we have a bad cycle in the stock market, we're going to be back down in the 50s and 70s. Shouldn't we be maybe targeting higher, and so when we have bad times, we don't overreact? If you could just give a quick history on what we've done and that line of thinking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, really that should be more of retirement directors. That's not State Investment Board's role to set pension policy. Ours is to invest the assets. But I know the numbers have been more volatile, but Mr. Bergstrom or one of the other directors could give you more history on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, we in 1999 were 109% funded. And as I go through the history, we'll see even as recently as 7 years ago, we were knocking on the door of 100% funded.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd just like to summarize, Mr. Bicker, your statement essentially is that when times are good, we should not overreact and start spending money through increases that we may not be able to sustain later. And when times are bad, we should not overreact by dramatically increasing contributions or cutting down cost of living adjustments because things return to a level of normal over a 30-year window. That's essentially your summary view.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, if you're going to have a portfolio invested to make 8.5%, you're going to have a volatile portfolio. And therefore, you can't react, or I shouldn't can't, but it's not wise to react to standard deviations. We expect, if you set a policy like that, you have a standard deviation around 9%. So two-thirds of the time, we expect to be from 0 to 15. Okay, so we make 0. We expect to be at 0. That's not unexpected. And we just, if you're going to do that, that's the math. And, on average, we think we can make over 8.5% over long periods of time. But it's on average.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up, this is also very high level, but and this is maybe not directly in your area of expertise, I guess, but we did make some mistakes in the 1990s when things were going very well and make some adjustments in benefits that were probably not sustainable. And last year we had to start to address that issue and move things back significantly in the other direction. I guess the question, it seems to me the question is, over the next 5 to 10 years, we have to continue to look at the unfunded liability and determine if additional adjustments are necessary to correct, perhaps, for some of the more overly optimistic policy decisions that were made in the 1990s.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, again, that's more for Mr. Bertram. The only thing is, my father-in-law is a retired teacher, so I can't say they were wrong, because he would not be happy with me.
I agree with that. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bick, the way I've heard this presentation, it seems like you focused on an 8.5% return as being your goal, and you accept whatever amount of risk or volatility that gets you to that goal. If I've mischaracterized that, you should correct me. But if I did do that correctly, what return could we expect from a portfolio that had less risk, sort of a market level of risk? I mean, I would hate to think that we're just trying to purchase returns by taking on whatever risk that's out there in the market after we've just experienced this, whatever you want to call it, Black Swan or Six Sigma event that's happened in the market over the last couple of years.
Mr. Becker. Chairman and Representative, the reality is we've had this asset allocation basically in place for 20 years. I mean, we're not chasing anything. We think this is a good long-term policy, and we've stayed there. To be honest with you, it was not fun in 2008 and 2009 to sit in our offices. I mean, we were glad we weren't more than three floors up, because we would have had a loss on people. But we also were sitting there with a disciplined approach, and to be honest with you, one of the toughest things we ever did was rebalance the portfolio and bought stocks in the fall, in the winter of 2008. Now, that was really hard, and it kept going down. Now, thank God we did, but if you're going to do this, you got to do it on a disciplined approach. You got to set a long-term asset allocation and stay there. If you want to market time, dogs that chase cars and those who mark time, time markets don't last long.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bicker, I just to follow up on that. So your perception is that the risk that's in the market, your perception of that risk, and you've been at this a very long time, you're a veteran, appreciate that. Your perception is that that risk overall over the long window hasn't changed, and you're just riding out a storm.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, everybody said all the correlations went to one in 2007 and 8, and they did. They're back. Okay, and the reality is the bond market got murdered, and the stock market got murdered. They have recovered. You know, the mortgage-related securities that a lot of people bought that went down in price, to be honest with you, most of them have recovered. We have not sustained any permanent impairment in any mortgage-related securities that we own. You know, it's the volatility is there. It's always going to be there. We just believe that if you're long-term investors, and what is more long-term than a 30, 40-year time horizon, we are there to try to make money over the long period of time.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Just briefly, I'm interested in the on your table of what's happened in other states. The new hybrid plan added in Michigan and Utah. Is there a one-sentence description of what those plans are? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, Dave.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, essentially they're a little bit lower defined benefit plan with a defined contribution plan layered on top.
I've been interested in looking at that approach for Minnesota as opposed to moving to a totally defined contribution plan. I think it gives you the best of a certain level of stability, and then the ability to make more exotic changes if you want to.
Anything else, Mr. Bicker, Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, I plan on a short introduction because I know you're short of time, and we plan on visiting all of you. I'm sure you're all excited about that. So what we'd like to do is come around one-on-one and give you more detail. MSRS is the acronym you'll be hearing often. That stands for the Minnesota State Retirement System. We cover state employees, University of Minnesota non-faculty, Metropolitan Council employees, non-faculty MinSCU employees, and a few others. We are governed by an 11-member board. Four are elected by our membership. I won't read all of that. We have three governor appointees on our board, but it's been a very responsible board, very conservative board, quite frankly, over time. The assets that we have total $13 billion. 9.1 of that is for our retirement plans, $3.9 billion of which are for our supplementary or voluntary plans, and I'll talk just briefly about those as we go. The biggest plan that MSRS administers is the General Employees Retirement Plan, and it shows the assets, and these are on a market value as of June 30th of 2010, just going across the top, and then you can go down the bottom. We had about $7.7 billion in assets as of June 30th. I looked at that number this morning. It's up to $8.7 billion. So in 1 year, we have added $1 billion to that fund because of the market return of 16%. We have 48,494 active members, 28,435 benefit recipients, and we have 15,000, roughly, people who have left state government who will someday be eligible to collect, and that's what we call them deferred members. So they're no longer working, but they kept their money on hold and will someday collect. I won't read down all of the numbers, just kind of as a highlight. The legislator's plan was closed in 1997 to new elected legislators. Most of you are in the unclassified plan. That is a defined contribution plan that has a 5% employee contribution and a 6% employer contribution. So other than some longer service members, most of you are in the unclassified plan. I would say for most of your employees are in that plan as well. The employees have an option to switch to the general plan if they so choose. You earlier asked questions about the number of participants. The only defined contribution plan we have for the primary plan would be our unclassified plan, and we have roughly 3,300 total. 1,430 active and 1,844 still investing their assets. We also administer some statewide plans. Any city, county, state employee can participate in our deferred compensation plan. It's a voluntary savings plan governed under 457. We're the fifth largest deferred compensation plan in the country. We have about 80,000 participants in that and about $3.5 billion. We also administer probably the largest health care savings plan in the country, and that is set up by Employer's Choice, and that has 317 million and 63,000 participants. We also administer a small supplemental plan for Hennepin County. Looking a little bit at the funding more specifically for the Minnesota State Retirement System, and Mr. Martin went over this, on the left-hand side is the funding on an actuarial basis, and it really shows the sort of the lack of volatility when you do smooth gains and losses over a five-year period. I will focus on the market value side just because that seems to be interest. The market value in 2007, June 30th of 2007, MSRS was 98.7% funded. So we were knocking on the door of full funding. Then with a market drop of 5% in 08, we dropped to 88.5. 2009, 18.8% loss, down to 65. As of June 30th of 2010, we were back up to 75. If we did it today, we'd be up about 83%. Based on the 16% return. That shows the volatility of the market. MSRS employee contribution rate to this plan is 5%. The employer contribution rate is 5%. That is among the lowest in the country. The average employer contribution in the United States in similar situated plans is close to 9%. The average employee contribution is about 5%. So we have a very cost-effective plan. And I would like to add, if you look at our contribution rate, a very stable plan. If you go back through the 80s, most of the 80s into the early 2000s, we had a 4% employee and a 4% employer contribution rate. And we did tick that up after the market downturn in 2000. So it shows a very stable retirement plan. We also administer some public safety plans. They generally allow an earlier retirement age. The correctional plan, you can see on a market value, was as high as 84% in 2007, is back to 61.7%. That too would be higher today. I did not do that calculation. The employee contribution rate for that plan is 8.6%. The employer contribution is 12.1%. State Patrol plan, which has probably in the neighborhood of 800 active employees. Again, on the market value, was as high as 96.3, dropped to 62 at its low point, has climbed back up to 71%. I will say our state patrol plan was hit harder by the drop in the market because it has more of a liability on the retiree side. You have a smaller active side compared to retiree, and when the markets dropped, that plan was hit a little bit harder. The current contribution rate is 10.4. The employer contribution is 15.6. Last year, in the bill that we introduced to bring us back to sustainability, this was the only plan we asked for a contribution rate increase. We asked for and the legislature approved the 2% employee contribution rate and the 3% employer contribution rate, which will go in effect in July of this year. I'd like to talk then briefly about the benefit reforms that we made.
Perhaps before you go there, Representative Murphy, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bergstrom, back on the 8, you were making a comparison with national. Would you repeat that again?
Yep, Mr. Chair.
We were at 5% employee-employer and nationally something.
Yep. Mr. Chair, our employee contribution rate is 5, and that is about the average nationally, so it's about even. Our employer rate of 5% compares nationally to about 9% of an average employer contribution rate if we look at similarly situated plans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, I guess I'd like to follow up on something from Mr. Bicker. I think in our materials it says that Minnesota's 8.5% return target is higher than other states. And I wonder if you could just give a little bit of either information or speculation as to why Minnesota's employer contribution is 5% versus 9%, whether it relates to the growth percentage target that we have or whether it relates to more disciplined management over time.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, we are at 8.5%. The most common use in other states is 8% from an investment return. I personally think it has to go back to the legislature has done a very nice job of funding the Minnesota State Retirement System. At one point we were 109% funded. We have the legislature traditionally has avoided a lot of the mistakes the other states have made. You talk about in Illinois or in New Jersey where they didn't even pay the employer contribution rate, or they underfunded their retirement plan. And that's what tends to get you into a lot of trouble. So I do think the reason that our contribution rates are lower is because we were well funded. Until recently, MSRS had a very small unfunded liability. And that's where you start building up the cost, is to pay off sort of that unfunded nature.
Just a quick follow-up.
Winkler, yeah.
I don't think you said gave a comparison on either the actuarial value or the market value funding percentage that we have in Minnesota versus average among other states, and perhaps compared to some of the worst states.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, on an actuarial basis is which most of the comparison that we have. Last year we were at 85.9. If I remember correctly, the average was at 79 on an actuarial basis. It's hard. I don't have the statistics on a market value. What you'll see this year when we do the comparison, which won't be till a year later, because we reduced our future liabilities, you can see MSRS's actuarial funding value went up this past year, where in other states where they have not done that, you'll see that tailoring down. So I think the difference will be even broader. So from an actuarial funding standpoint, we were about 5% higher than the average. I just don't have the market value.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder if you could compare to New Jersey, Illinois, potentially California, if you have any sense of that.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember. I would be happy to provide that for you. I have a lot of statistics. But you hear about California, you hear about Illinois, you hear about New Jersey. I believe Illinois maybe in the actuarial in the 50 or under 50% basis. I think one of the Virginia, I don't know if it was West Virginia, was in the below 20% funded. I mean, there have been some chronic issues in our business throughout the country. I would say, to the most part, Minnesota has avoided those. You did talk earlier about the 90s, where we paid large increases to retirees. That was a mistake that we have taken care of. For the most part, the state has done a nice job of their pension.
We've got two more folks that we wanted to hear from, and we're not going to have adequate time to do that. So we can have them make a few comments and then bring them back if they're willing to do that. We had a couple more questions here, Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's good to remember that when we talk about the state's money and the state's funding, it's the people's money, so we always want to be prudent with that. I was wondering, when you talk about the match, 5% employee, 5% state, is there a cap on or a maximum that we would actually contribute, even those with high compensation, or is it just 5%?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is pretty much 5% for everyone. There is a cap. From a federal standpoint, I believe it's in the $170,000 range, but very few state employees. I think we have a few physicians, like at the University of Minnesota, that hit it. But otherwise, we have no cap on the salary in which to contribute. Obviously, someone with a higher salary is paying more of a portion for their retirement.
Right. And just one follow-up.
Yes.
We're comparing ourselves to states in a similar situation or similar retirement plans, but what is the typical private industry doing in terms of match? Because I think state employees have a very generous plan relative to the average person who works for a company. Do you have any comparisons on company plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the from a 401k standpoint, the most often used match for private sector is about 3%. And then profit sharing has averaged in the 3 to 4% range. Now, granted, recently it hasn't been that, but the last study that I looked at was roughly, when you add the two together, about a 7% match. Now, there are still some defined benefit plans offered to the large employers, and MSRS would favor comparable to theirs, probably in some cases. I think the auditor did a report several years ago, and we were less. So I don't think we are out of line with the private industry when you look at those two pieces together. I will say, in private industry, over the last couple of years, a lot of companies have either stopped or reduced their contributions, which I understand, but from a pension plan standpoint, it's absolutely the worst time to do it, because when the market rode up, they're not putting money in, and that gets to be a problem. But that kind of gives you a sense.
Thank you.
Mr. Bergstrom, wrap it up so we can at least get a couple of your colleagues for a few minutes.
Mr. Chair, I won't go through the details. Mr. Martin talked about the lowering of the increases. But I would say that Minnesota, again, was one of the leaders. You, as a legislature, took some very important steps to slow the growth of our liabilities, along with the dramatic increase in our assets. That plan has worked. With that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Ms. Vanek and Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. I've been with PARA for 36 years, the last 14 of which I've been the director. So we've seen a lot of history. I don't know how much you want us to cap right now, if you want us to come back, Mr. Chair.
Well, I want to give you adequate time to explain, and obviously we don't have that in the next 5 minutes here. Okay. So if you wanted to make some introductory comments, and then we will bring you back as soon as it can be arranged.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. PERA covers local government employees. All city, county, and non-teaching school district employees are covered in our plan. About 47% of our membership comes through the school districts through the non-teaching positions. We have a membership of about 158,000, including our police and fire plan and our correctional plan that's active. And now, with the addition of the MRF division, we are paying benefits to about 80,000 people. As of June 30th, our asset value was roughly $16.9 billion. And the pension bill lowered our unfunded liabilities over $3.5 billion. So the details of the presentation that I was going to give today would give you more background on that. But over $3.5 billion was the reduction in our unfunded liability, specifically related to the bill that was passed by you last year. So we look forward to sharing that with you.
And that's on this handout that you...
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Hacking?
I'm with the Teachers Retirement Association, and just fast forward here. We cover all K through 12 public school teachers, including charter school and some state university and community college faculty. And we have an 8-member board of trustees. Our assets were at $14.9 billion. But as Mr. Bergstrom reported, we've had quite an asset increase since then. We're up over $2 billion. We're now close to $16.9 billion in assets. We serve over 77,000 active members and 52,000 benefit recipients. Just briefly, I want to draw your attention. You've seen the funding ratios on page slide 19. I wanted to talk a little bit about contribution rates, because our history is, I think, illustrative of what can happen and reflects some of the discussion you had this morning. You can see in the bottom of this slide, the blue line is our employee contribution rate, the red line the employer rate. The employer rate was quite high through most of the 1980s and 1990s. It was between 8 and 9% because we had a significant unfunded liability back then. The employee rate was lower but had capped out at 6.5%. But you see in 1997, both of those lines dramatically dropped to 5% and have been fairly stable since then in 5.5%. The reason they dropped was, as was described earlier, we hit full funding. We were over 100% funded for a fairly long period of time. And this drop was, in a sense, in statute. Understanding was, well, we were fully funded. We didn't need to keep any excess assets in the fund. And that is why the contribution rate decreased dramatically. Now, that lowered costs quite a bit for school districts, for the state, which was helping to fund those costs through the school aid formula. So that was something folks could benefit from. But as Mr. Bicker explained, we do have a volatile market, and particularly in the decade of the 2000s, we've had a lot of volatility. So now there is a need to look at those contribution rates again and increase them in the future. Last year, the 2010 benefit reform bill that went through had some of the same cuts that you've heard described, and actually TRA went a bit deeper with the annual increase cut. We are in a freeze year period of 2 years where our retirees are not getting any increase at all. Again, we felt we had to do this because we are retiree liability heavy and we needed the savings in the short term. In total, we reduced our unfunded liabilities by $1.75 billion as a result of those benefit reductions. I won't go into great detail about what happened in other states. You've heard a bit about that. I have a handout here if you're interested, a nice side-by-side chart that compares what other states have done. I want to emphasize that in other states, there are many other states that have no contributions coming from employees. Minnesota has been pretty diligent about keeping almost an equal sharing of employee and employer costs. So I want to leave with just one point on this, and that is that we have been a bit more, I'd say, conservative in Minnesota than other states. We've been very disciplined about our funding approach and correcting problems when they occur. We don't let them fester, as you've seen in states like Illinois, New Jersey, California. Our benefit levels are relatively modest compared to other states. You see there's Census Bureau data. Our employer contributions represent only 1.6% of Minnesota state and local government spending compared to 2.9% for the average of other states. We've been proactive about benefit reforms. You heard discussed that we did have very high retiree increases in the late 1990s. That has been corrected through reforms that were passed starting in 2006. And one other thing I want to emphasize, in other states, you've seen them increase the retirement age to 66 to 67. Well, Minnesota did that a long time ago, 1989. For anyone hired after 1989, the normal retirement age, the full benefit retirement age, is 66, and we eliminated the rule of 90 as well. So we don't have the kind of early retirement subsidies that you see in other states. Right now, three-quarters of our active membership in our funds are under these new benefit provisions that have no rule of 90 and an age 66 normal retirement age. And then lastly, employees in Minnesota generally contribute almost half of the cost toward the pensions. Unlike private sector plans that have defined benefit plans, they're not employee contributory. Where Minnesota employees also have a high amount of contribution. So with that, you heard discussion about a pending lawsuit, and you were briefed on that. One last thing is our benefit design study is due to you June 1st, and we have had several public meetings on this, and we are on schedule, and we'll have that report wrapped up and sent to you.
Well, thank you, and we will have you back to have a chance to further describe your funds and respond to questions. Members, please save this in your files so that we can come back to this. Meeting adjourned.